Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 107.
Okay, let's unpack this from the top, because I want to look at the macro-political level first.
Yeah, let's start there, because the fate of this entire family bloodline is being decided in a high-stakes interrogation room.
Exactly. Ji Zheng, who is essentially the orthodox, rule-following patriarch of the family at this moment, he has been hauled before the Prince of Beijing and the Privy Council.
Which, just to be clear, these are the emperor's inner circle.
The absolute top.
And they are interrogating him regarding a laundry list of severe crimes committed by his older brother, Jiaxi, and his nephew, Jiazhen.
The imperial censors, who are essentially the ultimate federal auditors here, have completely thrown the book at them.
Right. And what's fascinating here is the sheer gravity of an imperial audit in an absolute monarchy. It cannot be overstated.
No, it really can't. When censors target a family of this magnitude, the baseline expectation is annihilation.
Annihilation, like total wipeout.
We are talking about the potential seizure of all physical and liquid property, or permanent exile to the harshest military frontiers.
Or even the execution of the entire bloodline just to root out the corruption.
Yeah, the emperor does not deploy his censors for mere reprimands, you know.
Right, it's not a slap on the wrist. And the charges themselves paint a picture of an aristocracy that is entirely out of control.
Oh, completely. They accuse the brother, Jiaxi, of associating with outside officials.
Which, I mean, in a modern context, that sounds like simple networking, right?
Yeah, it sounds like going to a corporate mixer.
Mm-hmm.
But in an imperial autocracy, building a shadow power base or engaging in unsanctioned lobbying is a direct threat to the throne.
It's basically treason. And they're also charged with systemic bullying and this forced concubinage that directly resulted in a young woman's suicide.
And relentlessly pursuing a man over a stolen antique fan.
Oh, the fan incident.
Yeah, to the point where he, too, took his own life.
So Jiazheng is kneeling before the council, probably sweating through his silk robes, and he essentially pleads guilty by way of gross negligence.
Right. He claims he was away on government assignments, being a diligent public servant, and he just failed to audit his own household managers.
He throws himself entirely on the mercy of the court, anticipating the absolute worst.
But the emperor's response to that plea is where the mechanics of absolute power become truly visible.
This is the part that blew my mind, because the emperor has already conducted a parallel investigation, right?
Exactly, into the censor's charges. And the results of that secondary review are heavily, heavily engineered.
Engineered how?
The imperial court systematically downgrades the severity of almost every single charge.
Wow.
They take the antique fan incident, where a commoner known as the Stone Idiot was hounded to death by Jiaxi over a family heirloom.
Right.
And the official imperial review concludes the victim was already mentally unstable.
Wait, really? They blamed his mental state.
Yes. They frame it as a tragedy of underlying madness. It aggressively severs the direct causal link between the aristocrat's extortion and the commoner's death.
The legal theater there is just astonishing. They use the victim's psychological state to legally shield the aristocrat.
And they employ the exact same legal buffering for the charges of forced concubinage involving a woman named Yu Erji.
Right. How do they spin that one?
The Imperial Review miraculously uncovers that because she was poor, and because her mother technically consented to the financial arrangement, it fundamentally cannot be classified as forced under the law.
Oh, wow. So because money changed hands with the mother, it's a contract, not coercion.
Exactly. And another suicide involving a woman named Yu Sanji is just written off as an unfortunate result of societal shame.
Completely ignoring the toxic pressure cooker environment the Jia family created that drove her to that despair in the first place.
They are deliberately sanitizing the narrative. Even though the Jia family's relentless greed clearly engineered these deaths, the imperial audit removes the direct legal liability.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more. Why does the emperor bother softening these charges? If they wanted to ruin the family, why let the facts, or at least this spun version of the facts, get in the way?
Well, the ruling authority is carefully calibrating the scales of justice to ensure the punishment does not demand blood.
Right. I'm looking at this imperial pardon, and it feels entirely like a highly calculated public relations stunt.
Oh, it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. The emperor isn't actually acting out of pure benevolent mercy here.
No, he's terrified. If he simply executes the Jiyas based on the censor's demands, the rest of the nobility will panic.
Exactly. He is protecting his own structural integrity. If the ruling class sees an ancient, powerful family wiped out overnight, they might revolt or hide their wealth.
So by downgrading the charges, the emperor gets to look perfectly objective and measured.
That is the precise function of this legal theater. An autocrat cannot rely purely on terror. I mean, terror creates instability. By publicly correcting the supposedly overzealous charges of his own censors, the emperor positions himself as the ultimate rational arbiter of fairness.
He validates the raid, proving to the common people that corrupt nobles are punished, but he simultaneously reassures the aristocracy.
He is sending a very clear message. We amputate the specific gangrenous limbs, but we do not burn down the entire aristocratic forest. And the punishments are heavily mitigated. Jia Shi, the brother who actually committed the abuses, is exiled to post stations to expiate his crimes through service.
And the nephew, Jia Xin, is stripped of his title and sent to the coastal borders.
While the younger generation, Jia Rong, is released entirely due to his youth.
And Jia Zhang, the patriarch who claimed negligence, he is pardoned completely.
The emperor even returns his confiscated personal property, citing his past administrative diligence.
Wow. So what's fascinating here is that phrasing, expiate their crimes through service. That's the key to understanding the institutional safety net, isn't it?
Absolutely. They are not thrown into a lightless dungeon to be forgotten. Sending them to the borders leaves a geopolitical door wide open.
So the system punishes them, but consciously preserves them as playable pieces on the imperial chessboard.
Yes. They can eventually earn their way back into the court's good graces. The political survival of the family bloodline is technically secured.
And Jia Xing is so overwhelmed by this calibrated mercy that he literally weeps with gratitude in the interrogation room.
He even offers to proactively surrender all of his inherited wealth and property to the state out of a sense of profound guilt.
Which is crazy. The Prince of Beijing actually has to stop him, essentially telling him, like, hey, don't push the theater too far.
Right. The emperor has dictated the terms of the mercy. Just take the pardon and go home.
But as Jia Xing is about to learn, securing political survival in a courtroom is vastly different from ensuring operational survival back at the estate.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The transition from the macro-political triumph to the micro-domestic reality is incredibly jarring.
It's a total whiplash.
This is the exact moment the external crisis mutates into an internal financial nightmare.
So Jia Xing rushes back to the grand family compound. The entire household has been holding its breath, completely unaware if he's returning with a pardon or an order for mass execution.
Right. The tension is just unimaginable.
He walks through the gates, and immediately the women of the household, specifically Lady Xing and Yu Shi, the wives of the two men who were just exiled, they are weeping bitterly.
And their grief isn't just a standard emotional response to their husband's leaving. It is a highly specific, terrifying realization of their sudden dependency.
Right, because for aristocratic women in this era, their entire societal identity, their physical safety, and their access to resources are inextricably linked to the titles held by their husbands.
Lady Xing internalizes this immediately. Her internal monologue is just devastating.
What is she thinking?
She realizes her husband is old and banished. Her son is loyal to his uncle rather than her. The property of their specific branch of the family is completely confiscated.
Wow. So she has been instantly transformed from a powerful manager of an estate into a dependent charity case.
Exactly. And Yu Shi experiences the exact same psychological freefall. She essentially ran the East Mansion, and now she is living under the roof of her relatives in the West Mansion, completely stripped of agency.
The floor has just dropped out from under them. But the true panic, the systemic panic, doesn't actually crystallize until Grandmother Jia speaks up.
The elderly matriarch. The ultimate moral authority of the inner household.
Right. She asks the most dangerous question possible. She looks at Jia Zhang, acknowledges that the East Mansion is confiscated, and asks for a basic accounting of their own side.
She basically asks, how much silver is actually left in our vaults?
The million-dollar question. Because her sons and grandsons are going into imperial exile, and the unwritten rule of that punishment is that you must provide massive amounts of silver for travel expenses.
Yeah, you have to bribe the guards to ensure they actually survive the journey.
And this is where Jia Zhang is forced to confront the operational reality he has ignored for years.
He hesitates. I mean, the shame of a patriarch admitting financial impotence to his mother is profound.
But she relentlessly presses him, right?
She does. And he finally confesses the truth. The vaults are empty.
Empty. Just nothing there.
The ancestral accumulation of silver is completely depleted. They are drowning in external debts.
And then he reveals the specific mechanism of their insolvency. He says they have been eating the next year's rent in the current year.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that phrase, eating the next year's rent in the current year is just so revealing.
Right, because in an agrarian aristocratic economy, wealth isn't just piles of gold, it's the right to extract agricultural yields from massive tenant farming operations.
Exactly. But because they have been maintaining a lifestyle that vastly exceeds their actual seasonal income, they have been borrowing heavily against unplanted crops.
They are essentially taking out massive payday loans using the assumed future labor of their peasant farmers as collateral.
They are mortgaging a future that hasn't happened yet just to pay for today's banquets and silk robes.
It's insane. The sheer scale of this delusion requires incredible psychological compartmentalization.
I mean, this compound houses hundreds of servants, sprawling landscape architecture, and requires a daily burn rate of cash that would stagger a modern corporation.
And the entire operation has been running entirely on fumes and speculative debt. They literally do not have the liquid cash on hand to pay for the survival of their exiled family members.
No, they don't.
And this is where I struggle with Jia Zhang's characterization as a diligent, responsible leader. He openly admits to his mother that he didn't realize the severity of the bankruptcy until he casually checked the account books the day prior.
The day prior.
How do you live in a sprawling compound surrounded by an army of servants and remain completely blind to your own insolvency?
Well, it's a very specific kind of blindness. His blindness is not accidental. It is a cultivated willful ignorance.
Willful ignorance, yeah.
The text constantly characterizes him as orthodox. He views his role through the lens of high moral philosophy, government administration, and reading classical texts.
So he thinks money is beneath him.
He genuinely believes that concerning himself with the granular mathematical reality of household logistics is beneath the dignity of a scholar official. He outsourced the actual survival of his family to his managers.
He assumed that because the facade of the mansion looked intact, the foundation beneath it must be solid.
And that is a catastrophic trap.
It really is. When the entire culture of an institution is built exclusively on maintaining the appearance of success, the person at the absolute top of the hierarchy is guaranteed to be the very last person to know when the money runs out.
Because everyone below them is terrified to puncture the illusion and deliver the bad news.
So Grandmother Jaya listens to this confession, tears streaming down her face, and she delivers an incredibly astute historical observation.
She does. She notes that she has seen families in the past, far wealthier than the Jias, experience similar crises. But those families managed to maintain their hollow frameworks for years, sometimes decades, before finally collapsing.
She is terrified by the unprecedented speed of their current freefall. She asks how it is possible that they cannot even maintain the illusion for a single year.
And Jia Zhang explains exactly why the collapse is accelerating. The imperial raid was the catalyst that fundamentally altered their financial reality.
Right, because a hollow framework can indeed stand for decades if nobody pushes against it.
But the emperor's raid violently stripped away the illusion of their creditworthiness.
Jia Zhang explicitly states that if their titles and salaries hadn't been formally revoked, they could have continued to shuffle the debt around.
They could have borrowed from a new merchant to pay off the old merchant. But the instant the state confiscated their titles, they lost their collateral.
The credit line was instantly severed. It is the aristocratic equivalent of a margin call.
Exactly. And Jia Zhang adds the final devastating detail about their social capital. He points out that their wealthy relatives, who previously benefited from the Jia family's immense influence, are now facing their own financial ruin.
Meanwhile, the associates who did not directly benefit from them are actively refusing to answer their letters.
The network capital, the favors, the alliances, the mutual defense pacts evaporated the moment they lost the emperor's favor.
So the official leadership of the family Jia Zheng, the exiled Jia Shi, the exiled Jia Zhen, they completely freeze.
They are quite literally sitting on the floor, weeping with Grandmother Jia.
They have no liquid assets, no strategic plan, and a terrifyingly short imperial deadline to fund the exiles' journey to the borders.
The designated patriarchal leadership has entirely failed.
Which brings us to this incredible pivot. When designated leadership paralyzes in the face of an existential threat, true power invariably steps in to fill the vacuum.
And in this case, that power is Grandmother Jia, an elderly woman who has supposedly been retired from active daily management for years.
She looks at these weeping, helpless men and realizes that passive grief will not meet the emperor's deadline. She just takes complete control of the crisis.
She orders her most trusted, high-ranking maid, Yuan Yang, to open her personal storage chests.
She is physically opening the vault of her lifelong accumulated wealth. We are talking about gold, raw silver, priceless antiques, and heirloom clothing.
Things she has hoarded since she was a young bride, slowly building her own independent economic fortress within the larger patriarchal estate.
And what is brilliant is that she doesn't just start throwing money at the panicked men. She executes a ruthlessly calculated, highly strategic distribution of assets.
This raises an important question, right? The mechanics of her asset distribution serve as a masterclass in crisis management and profound emotional intelligence.
Because she does not divide the money equally.
No, she distributes it based entirely on systemic vulnerability and strategic necessity. She pulls out 3,000 taels of silver for Jiaxi.
But she places a strict, non-negotiable stipulation on the funds.
2,000 taels are allocated for his travel and the necessary bribes to survive the guards. The remaining 1,000 taels are explicitly ring-fenced for his wife, Lady Xing, to survive on.
She forces a hard separation of the funds to protect the dependent wife. She knows exactly how this plays out.
An exiled man facing brutal conditions will invariably spend every single copper coin on his own immediate survival, leaving his wife destitute and starving back at the compound.
So Grandmother Jia instantly constructs a localized social safety net, and she repeats the exact same structure for the nephew, Jia Zhen, allocating funds for him while explicitly protecting his wife, Yu Shi.
But then she pivots and does something that completely subverts the traditional power dynamics of the family.
She turns her attention to Wang Xifeng.
Yes, Xifeng. She was the aggressive, incredibly sharp-tongued, deeply compromised chief operating officer of the household.
She managed the daily finances, collected the rents, and enforced the rules. But currently, Xifeng is deathly ill, consumed by guilt over the raid.
Grandmother Jia allocates a massive sum of 3,000 taels, specifically to Xifeng. And she issues a direct command.
This is wild. Yifeng is to keep this money herself, and her husband, Jia Lian, is absolutely forbidden from touching a single penny of it.
In the context of this heavily patriarchal society, legally, Jia Lian would have total control over his sick wife's assets.
So Grandmother Jia is using her immense moral authority to completely override the legal structure.
Because she knows Jia Lian is unreliable, prone to reckless spending, and utterly incapable of managing a crisis.
She also knows that Xifeng, despite all her corrupt flaws, literally worked herself to the bone trying to keep the sinking ship afloat.
It is a phenomenal intervention.
To use the corporate analogy again, Grandmother Jia is the legendary retired activist investor who was forced to step down from the board and physically enter the executive suite because the current C-suite is in a panic spiral.
She liquidates her own highly protected personal stock option.
She looks at the room and says, "You get the basic operating capital to survive the audit, you get a protected severance package, and you get a heavily guarded trust fund because your direct manager is completely incompetent."
And her foresight extends beyond the immediate living dependents. She hands over 500 taels of silver to Jia Lian with a highly specific, emotionally devastating instruction.
She tells him to hold those funds in reserve for the following year, explicitly to pay for the coffin and transport of Lin Daiyu back to the South.
Lin Daiyu was her beloved, tragic granddaughter who recently passed away.
Even while the family is in absolute financial freefall, trying to scrape together bribe money to keep their sons alive, the matriarch budgets for dignity.
She budgets for ritual obligation. She's managing the survival of the family's soul, not just its bank account.
Wow. And once the immediate cash crisis is resolved, she pivots instantly to operational restructuring.
She issues rapid-fire directives to the men. She orders them to take her remaining gold and liquidate it to pay off their external creditors.
But she intentionally holds back a reserve of silver and valuables, specifically for the youngest generation, Bar Yu and Jia Lan, ensuring that the future lineage has at least a fraction of seed capital to rebuild.
The restructuring commands are brutal and necessary. She tells them to dismiss the vast majority of the extra servants.
Since only one family member, Jia Zheng, retains a paying government job, maintaining the army of staff is a lethal drain.
So she orders them to marry off the maids or let them go. She commands them to sell the excess agricultural land.
And then she delivers the hardest command of all. She tells them they must formally return the Grandview Garden to the imperial state.
The Grandview Garden was the ultimate physical manifestation of their vanity. It was a sprawling, astronomically expensive landscape built exclusively to host a single, brief visit from an imperial concubine.
It was the vanity project that originally broke their financial back. So ordering its return is a profound, necessary act of institutional ego death.
She is looking at them and demanding that they completely dismantle the hollow framework.
Stop pretending to be billionaires when you can't make payroll.
Exactly. And as a final defensive maneuver, She orders them to send their remaining liquid silver back to the Zen family in the south.
She recognizes the extreme volatility of their political situation and reasons that if another imperial purge occurs, they need to ensure their closest allies aren't dragged down in the crossfire.
She is closing out their liabilities, returning massive favors, and securing their flanks before the ship sinks any further.
It is an exhibition of breathtaking administrative efficiency. And after she executes this massive restructuring, after she pulls them back from the absolute brink of destruction, she delivers a monologue that contains one of the most profound, devastating sociological insights in the entire novel.
She looks at her family, these people who've known nothing but unimaginable luxury, and she says, "I knew the inside was hollow even when the outside looks magnificent." But position alters the air. Nurture alters the body. You can't just step down from that stage instantly.
Position alters the air. Nurture alters the body. We need to spend significant time unpacking that quote.
This is not just a poetic phrase. It is a granular diagnosis of human physiological and psychological adaptation.
When I first read that line, it completely reframed my understanding of wealth. Position alters the air. The societal status you hold, the power you wield, literally changes the atmosphere you breathe.
It changes the way you walk into a room, the way you expect to be spoken to, the fundamental assumption of safety you carry in your mind.
And nurture alters the body. The constant access to high-quality food, the softest silk, the environment where you never experience physical discomfort or manual labor, it physically alters your biology.
You become acclimated to an environment of extreme, frictionless wealth in the exact same way a mountaineer acclimatizes to high-altitude oxygen levels.
Grandmother Gia is diagnosing the terminal disease of lifestyle creep. She is looking at her family and acknowledging that their inability to curb their spending was not merely a simple moral failing or a lack of discipline.
It was a physiological and psychological transformation. She is confessing, "I knew we were going bankrupt years ago. But I also knew that you cannot take human beings who have been selectively bred and raised in silk and instantly force them to wear coarse burlap and eat gruel without fundamentally breaking their minds and bodies."
She is acknowledging the acute physical pain of the descent. It isn't just about looking at a smaller number in a ledger. Losing that level of wealth fundamentally shatters who you believe you are.
The descent into poverty for someone raised in that specific environment is physically agonizing. It is a severe systemic withdrawal.
And through this acknowledgement, she is offering them a profound grace. She is saying, "I did not force the contraction earlier because I knew the internal shock to your systems would be devastating.
But now the shock has arrived violently from the outside. The emperor has forced our hand. The environment has permanently changed, and now we must contract to survive."
Jia Zeng is entirely stunned by this. His internal monologue reveals a moment of total humiliating clarity.
He thinks to himself that the old lady is the only person in the entire compound who actually understands how to run a household.
He realizes that he and all the educated men who paraded around quoting philosophy are the completely useless ones who steered the family into ruin.
It is a moment of deep self-awareness, though it arrives years too late to prevent the catastrophe.
But as brilliant and decisive as Grandmother Gia's intervention is, we must recognize its limitations. It is ultimately a financial and logistical tourniquet.
It successfully stops the immediate arterial bleeding of cash. But no amount of hoarded silver can stop the profound emotional, psychological, and physical rot that the raid has already accelerated within the individuals of the household.
Which forces us to pivot away from the spreadsheets and the ledgers and look directly at the immense human cost. We have to look at the bodies left on the floor.
Right.
Right in the middle of Grandmother Gia's brilliant masterclass in crisis management, a maid comes sprinting into the room. Wang Shifeng, the fierce, brilliant COO who was just granted the protected trust fund, is actively dying.
Shifeng had been battling a chronic illness for a significant period, but the shock of the imperial raid, the terror of the heavily armed guards tearing through her personal quarters, and most importantly, an overwhelming, crushing sense of personal guilt have catastrophically exacerbated her physical deterioration.
Her body is completely shutting down.
Grandmother Gia, despite her advanced age and the exhausting day she has just managed, insists on walking to Shifeng's quarters to see her.
The scene that follows is incredibly moving and psychologically dense. Shifeng is lying in bed, literally gasping for air. The moment she sees the matriarch enter the room, she is consumed by a profound, agonizing shame.
She genuinely believes in her heart that she is the sole reason the Magnificent household fell apart.
She manages to speak, and she says, "I was trusted with the management of this family, and I turned it upside down. I have no face to see you."
She fully expects the elders to hate her. She expects to be abandoned, discarded, and left to die in disgrace.
It is vital to analyze how the text isolates and weaponizes Zhen's guilt. As the operational manager, she was the one physically moving the money.
She was the one taking the bribes, issuing the high-interest loans on the side, and enforcing the harsh, increasingly desperate rules that kept the illusion of wealth alive for the men.
She was the one constantly bailing water out of a rapidly sinking ship, and she made deeply unethical, corrupt choices to do so.
Consequently, when the ship finally goes down, she assumes she is the hole in the hull. She internalizes a systemic collapse as a personal moral failure.
So what does this all mean? Why does Grandmother Jia choose to absolve her? Because she absolutely does.
She does. Grandmother Jia sits by her bedside, tells her to remain still, and says, "Those things were caused by the outside. It has nothing to do with you. Even if your things were taken, it doesn't matter."
She even brings her physical comfort in the form of silver and new clothes. Is the matriarch simply being gentle to a dying woman to ease her passing? Or is she acknowledging a much deeper, uglier truth about the family?
It is undoubtedly the latter. Grandmother Jia is acknowledging a profound systemic reality. Yes, Xifeng made terrible, corrupt, and cruel decisions.
But Grandmother Jia recognizes that the underlying systemic failure, the massive, unsupportable, hollow framework, was infinitely larger than any single mid-level manager.
Xifeng was merely a symptom of the family's terminal disease, not the root cause.
The root cause was the unchecked arrogance of the men, the structural decay of their political influence at court, and the sheer momentum of an agrarian lifestyle they could no longer afford.
Grandmother Jia is telling her, "You managed a corrupt system poorly, but you did not build the corrupt system."
It is a breathtaking display of leadership. In a moment of intense crisis where a weaker leader would leap at the chance to use Xifeng as a convenient scapegoat to absolve the family name, Grandmother Jia extends total unearned forgiveness.
And it actually works. Xifeng tells him that she feels the physical blockage in her chest loosen, just knowing that she isn't actively hated by the woman she respects most.
It is a moment of genuine grace. But the text does not allow the reader to linger in that grace for long. Right after this emotional absolution, the harsh bureaucratic reality of the imperial state reasserts itself.
The deadline for the exiles arrives.
The departure scene is utterly heart-wrenching. Jia Qi and Jia Zhen must begin their long, brutal journey to the borders.
The text makes a brilliant observation here, noting that those who are staying behind watching the departure are actually experiencing more profound heartbreak than the men who are leaving.
The narrative explicitly states, "The living separation is worse than death. The entire sprawling compound is echoing with the wailing of a fractured family."
And then almost immediately following the wailing, the narrative delivers a masterstroke of bitter, suffocating irony.
Literally the very next day, an official imperial decree arrives at the front gate of the compound. The emperor has formally granted the prestigious hereditary title of Duke, the exact title that was just stripped from the disgraced exiled brother directly to Jia Zhang.
The timing is sadistic in its perfection. The system breaks the family, banishes the brother, and instantly attempts to buy the loyalty of the surviving patriarch with the spoils of that destruction.
The gatekeepers at the compound, the servants who just watched the family weep in agony, immediately revert to their parasitic behavior.
They start aggressively demanding happiness money, essentially mandatory celebratory tips from the family to acknowledge the good news.
They argue this is a once-in-a-lifetime imperial pardon. The second master is now a duke. Pay up.
But the inner family is horrified. They find the demand entirely inappropriate and deeply offensive.
Jia Zhang is utterly miserable. He is inheriting ultimate political power, incredible status, and immense wealth, but it is directly, undeniably derived from his own brother's ruin. He recognizes it as blood money.
I mean, he's trapped.
I relate this to the intense phenomenon of survivors' guilt during a massive corporate layoff. Imagine your company goes through a brutal, sweeping purge. Your entire department is decimated. Your longtime mentor gets fired and escorted out of the lobby by security.
Right, it's a bloodbath.
And the very next morning, the HR department calls you into a meeting. They tell you that you've survived the cuts. But not only have you survived, they are giving you a massive promotion, doubling your salary, and moving you into the corner office that your mentor was just kicked out of.
You cannot puff champagne. You cannot celebrate.
The promotion feels inherently toxic, because your success requires their destruction.
It highlights the absolute absurdity and cruelty of social status in this autocracy. The imperial system demands that Jia Zhang display profound public gratitude for the promotion, but his basic human empathy makes him physically ill.
And the text twists the knife even deeper to expose the broader society. The instant the new title is publicly announced, all the fair-weather friends, the wealthy aristocratic relatives who had vanished like ghosts and refused to lend them a single copper coin during the raid, suddenly rush back to the compound.
Their arms full of lavish gifts to offer their congratulations.
It makes your stomach turn. It exposes the purely transactional, utterly soulless nature of their aristocratic network. When the Jia family's credit line was cut, those people did not exist.
The very second the emperor signals that the Jia family is back in power, they're beating down the front door with smiles and flattery.
We also see a stark, fascinating contrast in how different generations and personalities process this profound instability. Look at Baiyu, the young, pampered heir of the family.
He is explicitly described as someone who only knows the warmth of comfort and has never experienced genuine hardship.
When he walks through the compound and sees people weeping, he simply sits down and cries with them. It is pure, unfiltered emotion, completely lacking any real understanding of the political or financial stakes.
He functions like an emotional mirror. He just reflects the ambient panic in the room without comprehending the structure of it.
Contrast that pure emotional mirroring with Jia Zhang. Jia Zhang processes his immense grief by retreating entirely into strict adherence to orthodox ritual.
He rides his horse out to the city gates to see his brother off. He pours the ceremonial farewell wine with exact precision, and then he lectures his ruined brother on his moral duty to the state and the absolute necessity of repaying the emperor's mercy.
He hides behind the rigid, unfeeling rules of orthodox society because the actual reality of his family's collapse is too terrifying to face without a script.
He's desperately clinging to the employee manual while the factory floor is actively on fire.
Which perfectly sets up the final exploration, because if the absolute top of the hierarchy is paralyzed by grief, hiding in ritual, and pretending the promotion isn't toxic, what exactly is happening at the very bottom?
The narrative brilliantly concludes this sequence by shifting the perspective down to the lowest rung of the social ladder. And down there, in the servants' quarters, the text reveals a deeply tragic truth about the nature of loyalty within a fundamentally corrupt system.
The sprawling household is continuing its slow, agonizing decay. The remaining servants are not blind. They see the writing on the wall.
They start actively hiding, stealing valuables, avoiding their daily work, or pretending to be deathly ill so they don't get entangled in the mess or asked to work without pay.
But there is one notable exception, a newly arrived servant named Bao Yang.
Bao Yang's background is crucial. He was recently sent over from the Zen family in the south. He is an outsider to the specific, deeply entrenched dysfunction of the Jia family compound.
And Bao Yang is genuinely, fiercely loyal. He is a blunt, straightforward, physically imposing man, and he is absolutely infuriated by the hypocrisy and cowardice he sees in the other servants.
He watches them slacking off and stealing from the masters who feed them, but because he is so new, he lacks any institutional authority to stop them.
His frustration builds, and he starts drinking heavily to cope with his powerlessness.
One afternoon, while highly intoxicated and wandering the streets near the massive compound walls, Bao Yang overhears a casual conversation between two random commoners that completely shatters his worldview.
He hears them gossiping openly about the Jia family's spectacular downfall. One commoner asks, "How could a family that powerful fall? They had so many heavily placed friends in the government."
What about that incredibly powerful official, Jia Yukan? Didn't the Jia family basically invent his career and fund his rise to power?
And the other commoner scoffs and responds, "You don't understand how the capital works. Jia Yukan is the most ruthless of them all." When the censors initially attacked the Jia family, the emperor asked Yukan to lead the investigation.
Because Yukan was so closely tied to them financially and politically, he was terrified of being implicated in their corruption.
So to prove his absolute, unquestioning loyalty to the emperor, he kicked his former patrons while they were down. He actively ensured the violent raid happened to save his own skin.
This revelation is devastating. Jia Yukan represents the ultimate bureaucratic parasite. He is a man who attached himself to a wealthy host he fed on the Jia family's patronage, their immense wealth, their political introductions, to rapidly ascend the ranks of government.
And the exact moment that host became a political liability, he didn't just abandon them. He actively participated in their destruction to demonstrate his own ruthless efficiency to the new power center.
Bao Yang hears this, and the alcohol mixes with a surge of righteous indignation. He thinks to himself, how can there be such deeply ungrateful, treacherous people in the world?
And right at that exact moment, as if summoned by his anger, Jia Yukun's official palanquin, his massive, luxurious transport carried by guards, comes parading down the street. The guards are aggressively shouting for the commoners to clear the road for the powerful lord.
How does the fiercely loyal, heavily intoxicated servant respond to the man who betrayed his masters?
Bao Yang refuses to move. He stands his ground in the middle of the street, stares down the palanquin, and screams at it.
He publicly calls Jia Yukun a heartless, ungrateful creature who conveniently forgot the grace and money of the Jia family.
Jia Yukun hears the insult, peeks out, sees that it's just a drunk servant, and coldly ignores it, signaling his guards to simply move on.
But the true tragedy of this sequence is not that the powerful traitor ignores the lowly servant. The true profound tragedy lies entirely in how the Jia family leadership reacts to Bao Yang's display of fierce loyalty.
The other servants from the Jia household, the ones who were slacking off and stealing, witness Bao Yang screaming at a high-ranking imperial official.
They already hate Bao Yang because his genuine loyalty makes their corruption look bad. So they sprint back to the compound and immediately report him to Jia Zhang.
They frame it maliciously, saying, your new servant Bao Yang is out in the public streets, blackout drunk, causing a massive scene and hurling insults at Lord Yukun.
We must remember Jia Zhang's current psychological state. He has just barely survived a terrifying imperial audit. He was just forced to accept a title he feels guilty about holding.
His singular, overriding goal in life right now is total peace, quiet, and avoiding any further attention from the imperial court.
He turned around and severely punished the one single person in his entire orbit who was actually standing up for his family's honor against the parasite who orchestrated their downfall.
He punishes him because Jia Zeng's fatal flaw, the flaw that destroys institutions just as surely as greed, is extreme risk aversion.
He is not a true courageous leader. He is a frightened administrator who has been deeply traumatized by the raid.
He prioritizes immediate superficial order and politeness over rewarding genuine, messy, inconvenient loyalty. He is terrified that Bao Yang's outburst will draw the emperor's gaze back to their compound.
It is the ultimate corporate whistleblower scenario. Imagine a mid-level employee who discovers undeniable proof that a former high-level executive who used to work at their company actually orchestrated a massive sabotage campaign against the founders to steal their market share.
The loyal employee sees this treacherous executive at a public industry conference and loudly, aggressively calls him out in front of everyone.
It is incredibly messy. It violates corporate decorum, but it is the absolute truth.
And instead of the founders thanking the employee for aggressively defending their life's work, the HR department calls him in the next morning and fires him because he is causing a scene and damaging the brand's quiet period.
It is a flawless parallel. Jia Zhang summons Bao Yang, scolds him severely for his lack of manners, and banishes him to the absolute fringes of the estate.
He orders Bao Yang to go guard the empty, ruined Grandview Garden, forbidding him from ever interacting with the main household again.
He actively silences and discards his only true defender.